Candace Langford, pelvic and sexual health physiotherapist, and this is the Nurture Pod. We are talking pee, poo, pleasure, pain, periods, pregnancy, postpartum, peri, and postmenopause. All the P's, all supposedly taboo, yet essential to our holistic health and well-being. We are shining a light on each and every one of these, both confidently and comfortably. Let's get curious. Set the scene. You stub your toe on a awful day. You're stressed, you're tired, you've had a fight with someone. It is excruciating. Versus you stub your toe on the best day ever. It's sunny, it's the weekend, you're happy, you just ate cake. You barely even feel it, right? Isn't that pretty fascinating? Same tissue damage, very different experience. We are going to be discussing this, in its essence, with regards to pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain with none other than Dr. Sinead Dufour. I'm very excited about this. This woman was instrumental in changing my perspective when looking at anything with regards to pee poo, pleasure pain, periods, pregnancy, postpartum, in my pelvic and sexual health career. She looks laterally and deeply, not just at physio, not just at the physical anatomy, but really looking at many different facets of a person's experience and how we can effectively manage these things. Your draw is just about to drop, so brace yourself, because we are chatting to Dr. Sinead Dufour.
But first, one of the most common questions that comes my way is how to have better and more satisfying sex. Although this is multifactorial, I so value the potential of erotic audio content to pique mind and body arousal. The audio app Guided by Glow aims to do just that. Their guided sexual meditation journeys gives you the space to slow down, relax, and connect you to your senses, your creativity, and of course, nurture your relationship to pleasure as you drop deeply inside the feeling body. Listen until the end of today's episode for a special gift from Guided by Glow.
Okay, so Dr. Sinead Dufour is an associate clinical professor at the Faculty of Health Science at McMaster University. She teaches and conducts research in the School of Medicine, Nursing and Rehabilitation Science. She completed her master's in physiotherapy at McMaster University in 2003, her PhD in health and rehabilitation science at Western in 2011, and returned to McMaster to complete her postdoctoral fellowship in 2014. Her current research interests include conservative approaches to manage pelvic floor dysfunction, pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, which we'll get into today, and interprofessional collaborative practice models of service provision to enhance pelvic health and pain science. Sinead stays current as a pelvic health physiotherapist through her practice at The World of My Baby, which is The Womb, a family of perinatal care centers in Ontario, Canada. Sinead has been an active member of the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, which is SOGC, sitting on multiple committees and leading several clinical practice guidelines. She is also proud to serve as a clinical advisor for many women's health businesses. Her passion for optimizing perinatal care and associated upstream health profession, health promotions for women stem from her own experience of becoming a mother of twins. She is an advocate for women's pelvic health and regular invited speaker at conferences around the world. So considering this, we are very lucky to have Sinead here today. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Candace. Hi, everybody.
So, Sinead, I just have one question for you today. I mean, I've got so many tucked up my sleeve, but I'll save them for another day. But today, I really want to dig into with you the fact that you've got this unique perspective when it comes to pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. So please help us to understand this. Those of us that are patients or professionals, wherever we may be, just really, we need to know this. We need to share this. So please take the mic and teach us.
Absolutely. So my perspective, as you said, is unique. But what I'll say is that's unfortunate, because the perspective that I hold and the perspective that I teach is actually in line with our evolution of science. And the fact of the matter is that our sort of common narrative and our traditional perspectives around this clinical presentation or this pain presentation that, that women are faced with, a high proportion of women are faced with, really what we thought was, you know, related to this pain condition actually has now been disproven. And, you know, the narrative though of that, and I'll get into it in a moment, has really, really stuck, you know? And that's why my perspective really appears like it's unique, but actually my perspective and what I'm trying to translate is exactly what the science has really shown us actually from the perspective of lower back pain over the course of the last two decades. But now we have very, very clear data to show that this is exactly what's happening in pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain as well. So if I can just kind of
amazing
dichotomize the current kind of narrative, our traditional perspective, with really this updated, evolved perspective, I think that that will be helpful for people. So what we have thought
definitely
is that, you know, when we're pregnant, we have all sorts of hormones that help prepare our body, you know, to grow this baby, to get all the systems ready to do that. And then, of course, there's the time that we have to birth this baby. So we need to have adaptations in our body and our musculoskeletal system to be able to overcome this massive issue of physics, right? Where we have something very large needing to come out of an area that's very small. And of course, we have all a symphony of different things that happen in the body to make this possible. And so, you know, one of our hormones is lovingly called relaxin because it has many roles, but one of the roles is involved in softening some of the inert tissue in our body. So we're talking primarily about ligaments to, again, just help to support this physics issue that's going to happen, right? And so when we hear that name relaxin, understandably, it garners this sense of relaxing the tissues and making tissues very, very, very malleable, right? Just based on the name.
Yeah.
And so it isn't really surprising that it was assumed or hypothesized when women were getting this pain popping up, it was assumed, well, it must be that we just simply have just too much movement. Relaxin is there to help with this physics problem, and maybe in some cases it's overshooting, and therefore we have this issue. So if we just think to, in those cases, really, you know, help provide supports that make the pelvis a bit more stable or secure, that should kind of settle all our problems, and that's what the issue is. And again, it's a reasonable thought. It's a reasonable theory, but the problem is it's not true. And it actually has been shown over and over and over that it's not true. Even in a 2012 systematic review, we see that relaxin has nothing to do with pain that women have in their pelvic girdle when they are pregnant.
Yeah.
Right? We also...
Yeah, I mean, I think we... Sorry, Sinead. I think it's one of those things where it's almost the easy way out. You know, wouldn't it be so convenient if it was just as simple as that? It's because of X, and that X gives us Y, and this is what you need to do, stabilize. But yeah, most certainly, more and more, thankfully, we're hearing these messages that it's not relaxing, it's not about stabilizing. This is not an unstable part of your body. Beautiful. Thank you. I'm so glad that we are just busting this myth right now. But please take the mic back again, because I am just loving your content.
Yes. So you're quite right. Wouldn't it be great if it was that simple? But if it was that simple, then wouldn't every woman have this issue? Or wouldn't women whose bodies maybe produce an overshot of this hormone have this pain presentation similar in each of their pregnancies? Wouldn't then women like myself, who was pregnant with twins, where there is 3.6-fold relaxin have a higher incidence of this pain experience. And the fact is, none of these are the case. The theory doesn't match up at all to what we see. But you are quite right. It is one of those theories, belief systems, ideas that is so, so firmly held. And what we understand now is that actually perpetuating this perspective is harmful. And even evolutions of science now that have not only given us clues as to what's really going on in these women, which I'll get to in a minute, but has actually given us insight that perpetuating the notion that the pelvis is unstable and there's something kind of inherently at the mechanical level, not sort of optimal or driving a pain process, is harmful because it drives more fear, more co-contraction. We see that these women predictably have more interventions in their birth. So it's so, so incredibly important to me that we really are getting, you know, an updated correct perspective out, because our old narrative is actually hurting women. It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we think of, okay, well, so if it's not about relaxing or trying to get things stable, and if we shouldn't be telling women to keep their legs together and be careful how they move and strap on a stability belt, like if that's not where the answers are, then where are the answers? What is going on? And what do we do for these women, right? And so the most helpful place, I think, to start when really trying to shift our understanding, because it can be a tough thing to do, whether you're a woman who, you know, maybe can reflect on, you know, your last pregnancy and you were really struggling with this issue and you were told by many of your care providers and friends that it was a stability problem and you just kind of had to, like, you know, keep everything kind of stable. And really you found like, yeah, maybe some days that seemed like it helped, but there was a lot of times that it didn't, and you were still kind of struggling, but you were told, oh, don't worry, once you birth the baby, that'll like go away. And you kind of reflect on your experience. It might be hard to understand, well, it has to be that. Like, what else could it be, right? And so this is why it can be really, really helpful then to look at the established risk factors that have been established over and over and over again in different countries by different research groups, and they all line up to the same things. And actually that's why they're populated now in our most recent clinical practice guidelines. And when we look at the list of risk factors, that we see that not a single one corresponds to anything to do with biomechanics or stability, not a single risk factor, right? So what are the risk factors, right? Well, the first one is what we refer to as parity, meaning that this is a pain experience that we tend to see very infrequently in a first-time pregnancy. When we see it more, it's at a subsequent pregnancy. And that's really important because, I mean, that in and of itself, frankly, doesn't really tell us anything, because we have to then ask why. Like, why might that be? What really are the risk factors that are under that umbrella label, right? And when we start to understand a little bit more actually about some of what we understand, even in terms of like the ACEs study, adverse childhood events, and then how biologically that primes the threat response system, we understand what happens in a birth trauma. We understand sort of signs actually of PTSD after trauma and how highly prevalent those are actually after first time birth. I mean, it's really unfortunate, but there is a lot of intervention and a lot of trauma, like over 50% after first birth, right? So as we start to triangulate other databases of clearly what we understand, you know, changes our threat response system, we start to get some clarity as to why maybe it's this second pregnancy, especially when we're thinking about what happens with trauma in a first-time birth, right? Yeah. So that's one piece that might help to explain that risk factor. We look at the next risk factor, It's lack of belief of improvement. And again, when we think of the narrative of this issue, which is totally incorrect, the narrative is, this is a pain experience that has to do with the mechanics of your pelvis. And the mechanics of your pelvis in a pregnancy is sort of a moving target, that it's going to move towards a non-optimal place until you birth your baby. So it's no wonder that if a woman has that narrative in her mind and she starts to have this pain issue, she's going to start assuming that, oh my gosh, this is related to the pregnancy. So as the pregnancy gets more, this experience is going to get more exaggerated. And that, of course, is a horrifying thing to be thinking, that there's really nothing you can really do to nip it in the bud based on your notions of what you think the pain experience is all about, right? So again, yeah. We see yeah. that factor, nothing to do with mechanics. In fact, really highlighting how harmful perpetuating, you know, this unsubstantiated narrative is. The next risk factor is BMI. And many people think, oh yes, more weight. They think in terms of the mechanics of the weight, right? Even most physiotherapists oftentimes think that, oh, well, there's more weight. There's a mechanical issue. Even if we think of something, for example, like knee osteoarthritis, where we know that carrying increased rate is a correlative factor, right, to the pain experience and lack of function in these individuals. And many of our PT colleagues will assume, well, yes, it's the mechanics, it's the wear and tear, but we know that's not true now. We know actually that even in OA, it's mostly central mechanisms at play. And we know that actually weight is an issue because weight correlates with low-grade systematic inflammation. And this is the same we know with pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And this fact was proven actually in a huge study that included 11,000 participants, which is massive. So we can feel really, really confident with the findings that come through a study like that. And the researchers of this group, actually, many of them were the same authors of the European Guidelines for Pelvic Girdle Pain, which for anyone who's familiar with those guidelines recognizes that they're framed from very much this mechanical perspective. And so these authors hypothesized that, you know, hormones were really involved in this issue and that women who continued to breastfeed in the postpartum period, they would be the ones who would have this persistent pain going on, right? But actually what they found was that breastfeeding was highly protective of pain. And the only group it didn't protect were those who were obese and had high BMI. So they discussed the mechanism of that has to be inflammation. And the anti-inflammatory effect of oxytocin and breastfeeding, and it just wasn't enough of effect to overpower the really strong inflammatory effect. The obesity has nothing to do with mechanics at all. So that's, I think, important for us to understand. Then if we look at other risk factors, smoking, that's another inflammatory issue. That's another immune dysregulating issue. It has nothing to do with mechanics, right? Dissatisfaction at work is another one. Again, we're not talking about mechanics. So we can tease out the very clearly established risk factors. And it's very, very evident that yes, mechanics doesn't explain this. And then when we look at even our treatments that have a degree of evidence, once again, our treatment approaches that are very focused in the periphery, we don't have good evidence or efficacy that they work. We have much better efficacy in the strategies that are kind of more top down, that are really trying to look at how do we optimize the tissue from a sensitivity perspective, right? Thinking of this as not a biomechanical issue, but a tissue sensitivity issue. How do we, you know, consider aspects of low-grade inflammation, of balance in the autonomic nervous system? How do we address fear? How do we, and again, a lot of this is helping people to really understand how pain works, right? This is where our pain neuroscience education approaches, our mindfulness and acceptance-based approaches apply here, right? So we very much are called to, just like for lower back pain, where the whole concept of psychologically informed care actually grew out of the fact that our structural approach to back pain completely has failed. And that has been outlined very clearly in the Lancet series that was published in 2018, where almost in no cases can we actually track back pain back to specific structures in the body, right? And we're finally accepting that. And that's why we're saying we can't really have a mechanical approach to address back pain. We need this psychologically informed lens, right? Where we're really considering systems biology and how all these systems are manifesting then into the tissues, right? We have to address it all. Well, we're actually seeing the same thing for pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. So we're really seeing a parallel there.
Wow. I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one that is going to be, you know, feeling like my jaw is dropped listening to you. And if anyone's watching this on YouTube, you'll see that I'm just staring endlessly at the screen, just trying to absorb every single word that's coming out your mouth. And this is all just so important. And absolutely what I see with the patients that I encounter and the stories that I hear, you know, being supported, feeling as though going on the psychological support side, you understand, you have an element of control over what's going on. You know, someone's heard you, they're listening to you, they've said that your pain is valid, and they give you a comprehensive description as to what's going on. I find that that makes such a significant difference compared to someone that's you know, rushing into postpartum and then getting back to work and feeling unsupported and breastfeeding and feeling as though they're overwhelmed, their pain experiences versus someone that's feeling supported and cared for is just, it's chalk and cheese. And I think that's just a small portion of what you've mentioned thus far, but most certainly it's not just this biological thing, it's biopsychosocial. And I think it's even extending further beyond our normal psychosocial approaches that we are taking. It's just so beautiful to see that there's so much evidence that's just looking laterally, looking wider, really just taking into consideration the multifactorial components that contribute to someone's pain experience. And it's just amazing to hear you speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree with everything you just said there, Candace. And one thing I will say, because it's oftentimes when I'm speaking about the fact that, as you pointed out, we really do need to kind of look through this from a different lens, a psychologically informed lens. You know, the data is really clear on that. What I'm not saying, I'm not saying the mechanics are irrelevant. And so sometimes, you know, people who have experienced this issue and perhaps have, you know, received benefit from mechanical approaches, or, you know, colleagues of ours who are also integrating kind of peripheral tissue approaches will almost feel like they need to get a bit defensive if they're thinking we're saying that's irrelevant. That's not what the data is saying irrelevant. That's not what I'm saying is irrelevant. Yeah. What we're saying is that is part of it, but where we have made the mistake is we're assuming that as all of it, and we're making incorrect assumptions about like what is kind of changing the motor control in the pelvis, what is kind of making some structures protective and some structures not. We've made incorrect assumptions there, and we've made an incorrect sort of assumption by thinking all we do is focus on the tissues and periphery. What is probably a much better approach is helping someone to understand how their thoughts, their thinking, their understanding of pain, their past experience, for example, of maybe a traumatic birth, what's that's doing to their system, the automated protection in the pelvic floor, how that's impacting then the mechanics, and how, you know, if we can be working on, yes, some peripheral techniques, depending on, you know, what you're particularly good at as a PT. Some of us are really excellent and skilled with our hands to be able to put some inputs into the pelvis. Some of us are excellent with different forms of hands-on facilitating just movement and helping people to feel safer in their body from that perspective. There's different strategies that we can use, but the point is to say that if we are not addressing correct beliefs about pain. We're not addressing the fear component head on. We are not understanding that, you know, if we're seeing both pain as an output, as well as any altered mood as an output. So this might be anxiety. Mm. This might be depressed mood. Those are two outputs that are commonly associated with pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. They're two outputs that are commonly associated with an inflammatory state and are commonly associated with dysregulation in the stress response system. So if we're seeing these two outputs, because hopefully we're doing screening, right, for some of these pieces, then we need to actually be targeting those in our interventions. And it's why I'm a big, big fan, too, of, you know, all primary care practitioners, really, but I would say physiotherapists for sure, do a better job with integrating very basic lifestyle interventions. The amount of data connecting the importance of sleep according to a correct circadian rhythm, sleep that honors physical repair sleep that occurs between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. We have way more data to substantiate the connection of that to any form of lumbopelvic pain, including pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, than we do for half the mechanical things that we do in our practice. And, you know, it really, I think, calls on us to understand more about that and get better at sort of integrating that into our care plan. So yeah, that's another thing really that I would just say is, yes, the mechanics are important, but not how we thought. And so we don't ignore them, but we have to reframe how people understand that they're related, but we can't miss probably the more important things, which are the central factors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can resonate with what you're saying, because I agree, you know, we're not discrediting the value of a physiotherapist and hands-on care. We both have physiotherapy backgrounds. But one of the things that I've most certainly noticed, especially in, for example, my vaginismus patients, oftentimes it's about, I'm doing hands-on therapy, and that's got a lot to do with you realizing psychologically that there's no need to not anticipate pain. We can teach you that this is safe, this is okay, this is, you know, we can touch this without feeling threatened. So it's reconnecting that mind, that body, using the body to calm the mind, using the mind to calm the body, and just integrating it in that sense. So body work, it's not that it's invaluable, but we can use it with a different pair of spectacles on and try integrate the way in which that the patient has a behavioral response to that touch, for example. I was chatting to someone today that I do a little bit of consulting with, and I was saying, you know, sometimes you need to be mindful about standing on the right side of the bed versus standing on the left side of the bed. Sometimes when you approach someone from a certain side or from a certain limb, when you first meet them, let's say they've got trauma from that side, or that they've, you know, experienced something negative from that side, they may be anticipating pain, and then they get the clenching of the jaw, the holding of the breath, the gripping of the tummy, because they're anticipating something negative or threat from that side. So we, as body work practitioners that are putting hands on individuals, we need to be mindful as to the anticipation of pain, the psychological state that comes from it, the behavioral responses that follow whatever approaches it is that we're having. So it's not invaluable, but like you say, coming from a being psychologically informed is so, I mean, that's brilliant. And that's something that should be included in our university studies. I mean, I don't know if it's changing now. I'm sure it is. You'll be better informed about that than I. But absolutely fascinating. I'm so grateful for all this incredible information that you are sharing. Is there anything else that you're wanting to add from this amazing discussion that you've really blessed us with?
The only thing I'll push through is, to your point you just said, you're quite right. Like, some of our usual strategies around manual therapy, highly valuable, but needs to be through the right lens. I would say the same thing even about pelvic supports. So it's not to say that, you know, it's bad to attempt to use, you know, a pair of sort of compression leggings when someone's pregnant to kind of provide some of that external support, or even more of an elastic style sort of belt or support. If we are framing that as a stability solution for a stability problem, that is not good. But if we are using that as another tool to make an individual feel supported, to provide some inputs into their nervous system, I'm a big fan of the leggings, SRC leggings, to be used during pregnancy, because they really help to support the vascular system and the lymphatic system. And one of the things we see when the threat response is going off, right, is that sort of low energy or depleted energy or an empty battery is a very clear, understandable reason why your threat alarm will go off, why you will have more pain. And you will see this over and over again with these mamas. So they will say, oh my gosh, the pain is just brutal. I get home from work, I can barely muster enough energy. My pelvis is so sore to even make dinner, to get dinner on the table. And again, our energy system tanks at 3 o'clock. So when women can start to understand, you know, that is their body simply communicating to them, you are done. Like, you have all this energy trying to grow another human being. You're trying to work, you're trying to care for this other child. Again, we see this as an issue more in the second pregnancy. There's another reason why we think it happens, because of the energy system, because these moms are very, very depleted. We do not have the support we were meant to rear children and families. It's meant to take a village, and we live in a way that's in a total mismatch to our biology, you know, end stop. And another place it manifests is in this pain presentation. So, you know, I really like women to understand that it can be very, very helpful for them to kind of almost do like a reboot, if they can, around 3 or 4 o'clock, if they can kind of get themselves away from dependence, away from work for 10 minutes and get into a very rejuvenating, like legs up the wall type of a position where they can diaphragmatically breathe for a few minutes. They can gently get their pelvic floor going for a few minutes. They can engage in some ankle pumping and really sort of almost shift into the parasympathetic side of their nervous system for a few minutes, that they will find always that after, it's such a different experience now when they're attempting to make dinner and they're starting to connect, you know, what's really at the root of their alarm system. So these leggings actually support your energy system because they're supporting those vascular systems. So I'm a much bigger fan of those, for example, versus belts. But the point is, as long as you're using that approach through the right lens, those are great, great tools. I mean, exercises that we think of as stability exercises are very much the same exercises that will keep a pelvic floor and the core fit. And we know that having a nice fit pelvic floor actually translates to shorter second stage and better pelvic floor health.
Okay, so Dr. Sinead Dufour is an associate clinical professor at the Faculty of Health Science at McMaster University. She teaches and conducts research in the School of Medicine, Nursing, and Rehabilitation Science. She completed her master's in physiotherapy at McMaster University in 2003, her PhD in health and rehabilitation science at Western in 2011, and returned to McMaster to complete her postdoctoral fellowship in 2014. Her current research interests include conservative approaches to manage pelvic floor dysfunction, pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, which we'll get into today, and interprofessional collaborative practice models of service provision to enhance pelvic health and pain science. Sinead stays current as a pelvic health physiotherapist through her practice at The World of My Baby, which is The Womb, a family of perinatal care centers in Ontario, Canada. Sinead has been an active member of the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, which is SOGC, sitting on multiple committees and leading several clinical practice guidelines. She is also proud to serve as a clinical advisor for many women's health businesses. Her passion for optimizing perinatal care and associated upstream health profession, health promotions for women stem from her own experience of becoming a mother of twins. She is an advocate for women's pelvic health and regular invited speaker at conferences around the world. So considering this, we are very lucky to have Sinead here today. So thank you so much for being here.
Hi everybody. So, Sinead,
I just have one question for you today. I mean, I've got so many tucked up my sleeve, but I'll save them for another day. But today, I really want to dig into with you the fact that you've got this unique perspective when it comes to pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. So please help us to understand this. Those of us that are patients or professionals, wherever we may be, just really, we need to know this. We need to share this. So please take the mic and teach us.
Absolutely. So my perspective, as you said, is unique. But what I'll say is that's unfortunate, because the perspective that I hold and the perspective that I teach is actually in line with our evolution of science. And the fact of the matter is that our sort of common narrative and our traditional perspectives around this clinical presentation or this pain presentation that, women are faced with, a high proportion of women are faced with, really what we thought was, you know, related to this pain condition actually has now been disproven. And, you know, the narrative though of that, and I'll get into it in a moment, has really, really stuck, you know? And that's why my perspective really appears like it's unique, but actually my perspective and what I'm trying to translate is exactly what the science has really shown us, actually, from the perspective of lower back pain over the course of the last two decades. But now we have very, very clear data to show that this is exactly what's happening in pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain as well. So if I can just kind of dichotomize the current kind of narrative, our traditional perspective, with really this updated, evolved perspective, I think that that will be helpful for people. So what we have thought is that, you know, when we're pregnant, we have all sorts of hormones that help prepare our body, you know, to grow this baby, to get all the systems ready to do that. And then, of course, there's the time that we have to birth this baby. So we need to have adaptations in our body and our musculoskeletal system to be able to overcome this massive issue of physics, right? Where we have something very large needing to come out of an area that's very small. And of course, we have all a symphony of different things that happen in the body to make this possible. And so, you know, one of our hormones is lovingly called relaxin, because it has many roles, but one of the roles is involved in softening some of the inert tissue in our body. So we're talking primarily about ligaments to, again, just help to support this physics issue that's going to happen, right? And so when we hear that name relaxin, understandably, it garners this sense of relaxing the tissues and making tissues very, very, very malleable, right? Just based on the name. Yeah. And so it isn't really surprising that it was assumed or hypothesized when women were getting this pain popping up, it was assumed, well, it must be that we just simply have just too much movement. Relaxin is there to help with this physics problem, and maybe in some cases it's overshooting, and therefore we have this issue. So if we just think to, in those cases, really, you know, help provide supports that make the pelvis a bit more stable or secure, that should kind of settle all our problems, and that's what the issue is. And again, it's a reasonable thought. It's a reasonable theory, but the problem is it's not true. And it actually has been shown over and over and over that it's not true. Even in a 2012 systematic review, we see that relaxin has nothing to do with pain that women have in their pelvic girdle when they are pregnant, right?
Sinead. I think it's one of those things where it's almost the easy way out. You know, wouldn't it be so convenient if it was just as simple as that? It's because of X, and that X gives us Y, and this is what you need to do, stabilize. But yeah, most certainly more and more you just, thankfully, we're hearing these messages that it's not relaxing. It's not about stabilizing. This is not an unstable part of your body. So beautiful. Thank you. I'm so glad that we are just busting this myth right now. But please take the mic back again, because I am just loving your content.
Yes. So you're quite right. Wouldn't it be great if it was that simple? But if it was that simple, then wouldn't every woman have this issue? Or wouldn't women whose bodies maybe produce an overshot of this hormone have this pain presentation similar in each of their pregnancies? Wouldn't then women like myself, who was pregnant with twins, where there is 3.6-fold relaxin, have a higher incidence of this pain experience? And the fact is, none of these are the case. The theory doesn't match up at all to what we see. But you are quite right. It is one of those theories, belief systems, ideas that is so, so firmly held. And what we understand now is that actually perpetuating this perspective is harmful. And even evolutions of science now that have not only given us clues as to what's really going on in these women, which I'll get to in a minute, but has actually given us insight that perpetuating the notion that the pelvis is unstable and there's something kind of inherently at the mechanical level, not sort of optimal or driving a pain process, is harmful because it drives more fear, more co-contraction. We see that these women predictably have more interventions in their birth. So it's so, so incredibly important to me that we really are getting, you know, an updated, correct perspective out, because our old narrative is actually hurting women. It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we think of, okay, well, so if it's not about relaxing or trying to get things stable, and if we shouldn't be telling women to keep their legs together and be careful how they move and strap on a stability belt, like if that's not where the answers are, then where are the answers? What is going on? And what do we do for these women, right? And so the most helpful place, I think, to start when really trying to shift our understanding, because it can be a tough thing to do, whether you're a woman who, you know, maybe can reflect on, you know, your last pregnancy and you were really struggling with this issue and you were told by many of your care providers and friends that it was a stability problem and you just kind of had to, like, you know, keep everything kind of stable. And really you found, like, yeah, maybe some days that seemed like it helped, but there was a lot of times that it didn't, and you were still kind of struggling, but you were told, oh, don't worry, once you birth the baby, that'll, like, go away. And you kind of reflect on your experience. It might be hard to understand, well, it has to be that. Like, what else could it be, right? And so this is why it can be really, really helpful then to look at the established risk factors that have been established over and over and over again in different countries by different research groups, and they all line up to the same things. And actually, that's why they're populated now in our most recent clinical practice guidelines. And when we look at the list of risk factors, that we see that not a single one corresponds to anything to do with biomechanics or stability, not a single risk factor, right? So what are the risk factors, right? Well, the first one is what we refer to as parity, meaning that this is a pain experience that we tend to see very infrequently in a first-time pregnancy. When we see it more, it's at a subsequent pregnancy. And that's really important because, I mean, that in and of itself, frankly, doesn't really tell us anything, because we have to then ask why. Like, why might that be? What really are the risk factors that are under that umbrella label, right? And when we start to understand a little bit more, actually, about some of what we understand, even in terms of like the ACEs study, adverse childhood events, and then how biologically that primes the threat response system, we understand what happens in a birth trauma. We understand sort of signs actually of PTSD after trauma and how highly prevalent those are actually after first time birth. I mean, it's really unfortunate, but there is a lot of intervention and a lot of trauma, like over 50% after a first birth, right? So as we start to triangulate other databases of clearly what we understand, you know, changes our threat response system, we start to get some clarity as to why maybe it's this second pregnancy, especially when we're thinking about what happens with trauma in a first-time birth, right? Yeah. So that's one piece that might help to explain that risk factor. We look at the next risk factor, it's lack of belief of improvement. And again, when we think of the narrative of this issue, which is totally incorrect, the narrative is, this is a pain experience that has to do with the mechanics of your pelvis. And the mechanics of your pelvis in a pregnancy is sort of a moving target, that it's going to move towards a non-optimal place until you birth your baby. So it's no wonder that if a woman has that narrative in her mind and she starts to have this pain issue, she's going to start assuming that, oh my gosh, this is related to the pregnancy. So as the pregnancy gets more, this experience is going to get more exaggerated. And that, of course, is a horrifying thing to be thinking, that there's really nothing you can really do to nip it in the bud based on your notions of what you think the pain experience is all about, right? So again, we see that factor, nothing to do with mechanics. In fact, really highlighting how harmful perpetuating, you know, this unsubstantiated narrative is. The next risk factor is BMI. And many people think, oh yes, more weight. They think in terms of the mechanics of the weight, right? Even most physiotherapists oftentimes think that, oh, well, there's more weight. There's a mechanical issue. Even if we think of something, for example, like knee osteoarthritis, where we know that carrying increased weight is a correlative factor, right, to the pain experience and lack of function in these individuals. And many of our PT colleagues will assume, well, yes, it's the mechanics, it's the wear and tear, but we know that's not true now. We know actually that even in OA, it's mostly central mechanisms at play. And we know that actually weight is an issue because weight correlates with low-grade systematic inflammation. And this is the same we know with pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And this fact was proven actually in a huge study that included 11,000 participants, which is massive. So we can feel really, really confident with the findings that come through a study like that. And the researchers of this group, actually, many of them were the same authors of the European Guidelines for Pelvic Girdle Pain, which for anyone who's familiar with those guidelines recognizes that they're framed from very much this mechanical perspective. And so these authors hypothesized that, you know, hormones were really involved in this issue and that women who continued to breastfeed in the postpartum period, they would be the ones who would have this persistent pain going on, right? But actually what they found was that breastfeeding was highly protective of pain. And the only group it didn't protect were those who were obese and had high BMI. So they discussed the mechanism of that has to be inflammation. And the anti-inflammatory effect of oxytocin and breastfeeding. And it just wasn't enough of effect to overpower the really strong inflammatory effect, the obesity. It has nothing to do with mechanics at all. So that's, I think, important for us to understand. Then if we look at other risk factors, smoking, that's another inflammatory issue. That's another immune dysregulating issue. It has nothing to do with mechanics, right? Dissatisfaction at work is another one. again, we're not talking about mechanics. So we can tease out the very clearly established risk factors, and it's very, very evident that, yes, mechanics doesn't explain this. And then when we look at even our treatments that have a degree of evidence, once again, our treatment approaches that are very focused in the periphery, we don't have good evidence or efficacy that they work. We have much better efficacy in the strategies that are kind of more top down, that are really trying to look at how do we optimize the tissue from a sensitivity perspective, right? Thinking of this as not a biomechanical issue, but a tissue sensitivity issue. How do we, you know, consider aspects of low-grade inflammation, of balance in the autonomic nervous system? How do we address fear? How do we, and again, a lot of this is helping people to really understand how pain works, right? This is where our pain neuroscience education approaches, our mindfulness and acceptance-based approaches apply here, right? So we very much are called to, just like for lower back pain, where the whole concept of psychologically informed care actually grew out of the fact that our structural approach to back pain completely has failed. And that has been outlined very clearly in the Lancet series that was published in 2018, where almost in no cases can we actually track back pain back to specific structures in the body, right? And we're finally accepting that. And that's why we're saying we can't really have a mechanical approach to address back pain. We need this psychologically informed lens, right? Where we're really considering systems biology and how all these systems are manifesting then into the tissues, right? We have to address it all. Well, we're actually seeing the same thing for pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. So we're really seeing a parallel there.
Wow. I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one that is going to be, you know, feeling like my jaw is dropped listening to you. And if anyone's watching this on YouTube, you'll see that I'm just staring endlessly at the screen, just trying to absorb every single word that's coming out your mouth. And this is all just so important. And absolutely what I see with the patients that I encounter and the stories that I hear, you know, being supported, feeling as though, going on the psychological support side, you understand, you have an element of control over what's going on. You know, someone's heard you, they're listening to you, they've said that your pain is valid, and they give you a comprehensive description as to what's going on. I find that that makes such a significant difference compared to someone that's, you know, rushing into postpartum and then getting back to work and feeling unsupported and breastfeeding and feeling as though they're overwhelmed. Their pain experiences versus someone that's feeling supported and cared for is just, it's chalk and cheese. And I think that's just a small portion of what you've mentioned thus far. But most certainly, it's not just this biological thing, it's biopsychosocial. And I think it's even extending further beyond our normal psychosocial approaches that we are taking. It's just so beautiful to see that there's so much evidence that's just looking laterally, looking wider, really just taking into consideration the multifactorial components that contribute to someone's pain experience. And it's just amazing to hear you speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree with everything you just said there, Candace. And one thing I will say, because it's oftentimes when I'm speaking about the fact that, as you pointed out, we really do need to kind of look through this from a different lens, a psychologically informed lens. You know, the data is really clear on that. What I'm not saying, I'm not saying the mechanics are irrelevant. And so sometimes, you know, people who have experienced this issue and perhaps have, you know, received benefit from mechanical approaches, or, you know, colleagues of ours who are also integrating kind of peripheral tissue approaches will almost feel like they need to get a bit defensive if they're thinking we're saying that's irrelevant. That's not what the data is saying irrelevant. That's not what I'm saying is irrelevant. Yeah. What we're saying is that is part of it, but where we have made the mistake is we're assuming that is all of it, And we're making incorrect assumptions about like what is kind of changing the motor control in the pelvis. What is kind of making some structures protective and some structures not? We've made incorrect assumptions there. And we've made an incorrect sort of assumption by thinking all we do is focus on the tissues and periphery. What is probably a much better approach is helping someone to understand how their thoughts, their thinking, their understanding of pain, their past experience, for example, of maybe a traumatic birth, what's that doing to their system, the automated protection in the pelvic floor, how that's impacting then the mechanics, and how, you know, if we can be working on, yes, some peripheral techniques, depending on, you know, what you're particularly good at as a PT. Some of us are really excellent and skilled with our hands to be able to put some inputs into the pelvis. Some of us are excellent with different forms of hands-on facilitating just movement and helping people to feel safer in their body from that perspective. There's different strategies that we can use. But the point is to say that if we are not addressing correct beliefs about pain, we're not addressing the fear component head on. We are not understanding that, you know, if we're seeing both pain as an output, as well as any altered mood as an output. So this might be anxiety. Mm. This might be depressed mood. Those are two outputs that are commonly associated with pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. They're two outputs that are commonly associated with an inflammatory state and are commonly associated with dysregulation in the stress response system. So if we're seeing these two outputs, because hopefully we're doing screening, right, for some of these pieces, then we need to actually be targeting those in our interventions. And it's why I'm a big, big fan, too, of, you know, all primary care practitioners, really, but I would say physiotherapists for sure, do a better job with integrating very basic lifestyle interventions. The amount of data connecting the importance of sleep, sleep according to a correct circadian rhythm, sleep that honors physical repair sleep that occurs between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. We have way more data to substantiate the connection of that to any form of lumbopelvic pain, including pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, than we do for half the mechanical things that we do in our practice. And, you know, it really, I think, calls on us to understand more about that and get better at sort of integrating that into our care plan. So yeah, that's another thing really that I would just say is, yes, the mechanics are important, but not how we thought. And so we don't ignore them, but we have to reframe how people understand that they're related, but we can't miss probably the more important things, which are the central factors.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can resonate with what you're saying because I agree, you know, we're not discrediting the value of a physiotherapist and hands-on care. We both have physiotherapy backgrounds. But one of the things that I've most certainly noticed, especially in, for example, my vaginismus patients, oftentimes it's about I'm doing hands-on therapy, and that's got a lot to do with you realizing psychologically that there's no need to not anticipate pain. We can teach you that this is safe, this is okay, this is, you know, we can touch this without feeling threatened. So it's reconnecting that mind, that body, using the body to calm the mind, using the mind to calm the body, and just integrating it in that sense. So body work, it's not that it's invaluable, but we can use it with a different pair of spectacles on and try integrate the way in which that the patient has a behavioral response to that touch, for example. I was chatting to someone today that I do a little bit of consulting with, and I was saying, you know, sometimes you need to be mindful about standing on the right side of the bed versus standing on the left side of the bed. Sometimes when you approach someone from a certain side or from a certain limb when you first meet them, just if, let's say, they've got trauma from that side or that they've, you know, experienced something negative from that side, they may be anticipating pain, and then they get the clenching of the jaw, the holding of the breath, the gripping of the tummy, because they're anticipating something negative or threat from that side. So we as body work practitioners that are putting hands on individuals, we need to be mindful as to the anticipation of pain, the psychological state that comes from it, the behavioral responses that follow whatever approaches it is that we're having. So it's not invaluable, but like you say, coming from being psychologically informed is so, I mean, that's brilliant. And that's something that should be included in our university studies. I mean, I don't know if it's changing now. I'm sure it is. You'll be better informed about that than I. But absolutely fascinating. I'm so grateful for all this incredible information that you are sharing. Is there anything else that you're wanting to add from this amazing discussion that you've really blessed us with.
The only thing I'll push through is, to your point you just said, you're quite right. Like, some of our usual strategies around manual therapy, highly valuable, but needs to be through the right lens. I would say the same thing even about pelvic supports. So it's not to say that, you know, it's bad to attempt to use, you know, a pair of sort of compression leggings when someone's pregnant to kind of provide some of that external support, or even more of an elastic style sort of belt or support. If we are framing that as a stability solution for a stability problem, that is not good. But if we are using that as another tool to make an individual feel supported, to provide some inputs into their nervous system, I'm a big fan of the leggings, SRC leggings, to be used during pregnancy, because they really help to support the vascular system and the lymphatic system. And one of the things we see when the threat response is going off, right, is that sort of low energy or depleted energy or an empty battery is a very clear, understandable reason why your threat alarm will go off, why you will have more pain. And you will see this over and over again with these mamas. They will say, oh my gosh, the pain is just brutal. I get home from work, I can barely muster enough energy. My pelvis is so sore to even make dinner, to get dinner on the table. And again, our energy system tanks at 3 o'clock. So when women can start to understand, you know, that is their body simply communicating to them, you are done. Like, you have all this energy trying to grow another human being. You're trying to work, you're trying to care for this other child. Again, we see this as an issue more in the second pregnancy. There's another reason why we think it happens, because the energy system, because these moms are very, very depleted. We do not have the support we were meant to rear children and families. It's meant to take a village, and we live in a way that's in a total mismatch to our biology, you know, end stop. And another place it manifests is in this pain presentation. So, you know, I really like women to understand that it can be very, very helpful for them to kind of almost do like a reboot, if they can, around 3 or 4 o'clock, if they can kind of get themselves away from dependence, away from work for 10 minutes and get into a very rejuvenating, like legs up the wall type of a position where they can diaphragmatically breathe for a few minutes, they can gently get their pelvic floor going for a few minutes, they can engage in some ankle pumping, and really sort of almost shift into the parasympathetic side of their nervous system for a few minutes, that they will find always that after, it's such a different experience now when they're attempting to make dinner, and they're starting to connect, you know, what's really at the root of their alarm system. So these leggings actually support your energy system because they're supporting those vascular systems. So I'm a much bigger fan of those, for example, versus belts. But the point is, as long as you're using that approach through the right lens, those are great, great tools. I mean, exercises that we think of as stability exercises are very much the same exercises that will keep a pelvic floor and the core fit. And we know that having a nice fit pelvic floor actually translates to shorter second stage and better pelvic floor health. And we're never treating conditions, we're supporting people, right? So we have to be thinking of, you know, what is going to be useful for a variety of different things. So it's not to say like, well, bridges don't work for pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain because bridges are a stability exercise. Well, no, you can utilize that movement strategy, but you're not framing it as correcting stability, right? That's really the big difference, right? And it does make a big difference. And then I guess the last thing I would say is really, I think the biggest trick with this issue is helping both practitioners, quite frankly, and women to really actually buy in to what we've just been talking about for the last half an hour, because this narrative of the mechanics and the relaxin is so strong. And sometimes women aren't going to believe it until they kind of experience it. So a very easy way to help people to start thinking, maybe it isn't about the mechanics, is even through a task of walking. So walking is oftentimes one of the things that women with this issue start having trouble with, right? And then understandably, they stop walking, they avoid it, they avoid moving, all the things that we don't want pregnant mamas to do, right? And they are very much associating the mechanics of the load of walking with this pain presentation. So understandably, that's something that they're going to want to avoid, right? So when we get them in to our offices, or maybe we're engaging in virtual care and we're kind of talking to them and helping to them to understand it, we can have them walk 10 steps forward. We can almost see the anticipatory response as they're like anticipating pain, because that is how pain works. And you made a reference to that earlier, Candace. But then we can say, okay, let's kind of sit back down. We're just going to sort of chat about something else. And then you have them get back up a few moments later and you say, now I'm going to have you walk backwards. So just do the same thing you did, but just turn around and walk backwards. And because walking backwards then in that instance is almost more like a novel movement, there isn't the same anticipatory feed forward. However, there arguably is very, very similar loading, right? And so when people experience that and recognize it was a totally different experience, and the ease with which they could move with that difference, and you say, but the loading and the weight on your sacroiliac joints was the same. The weight and loading on your symphysis pubis joint was the same, but your experience was totally different. And it's because the experience actually doesn't have anything to do with the loading. They can buy in a little bit more, right?
Yes.
So that I think is just a good, helpful tip, you know, to really get people to start to be more convinced, right? Increase their own conviction that we probably have to be less hung up on, you know, the proverbial leaf on the plant that has some brown in it, which I would say is the pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And if we're really trying to correct that brown, are we only going to be spraying water on the leaf and only going to be putting the leaf out in sunshine? Well, no, we're going to go into the soil, right? We're going to go upstream to all of the other systems, and then the leaf will get better. It's not to say that we might not also maybe give a little bit of a support to that leaf if it's drooping over, or we might, sure, we might do those things too, and that's great. But if we just do that and we're not mostly focusing on the soil, we're not going to get very far, or we're going to have to keep working on that leaf like every single day. And that's what we see a lot with these peripheral treatments. Women are in and out of these practitioners' offices a couple times a week or once a week. That's crazy. If we're doing the right strategies, women are empowered to make some shifts, and you only need to see them a couple times and they're better, right? So yeah, that's probably really the main things I wanted to say about the topic.
Absolutely incredible. And I love the analogy of the plant. I think that will really help with buying in, but also using a quick little assessment almost, or demonstration of walking backwards, so that the person realizes, wow, this really isn't what I expected it to be. And now they're going to be more likely to start paying value to sleeping well, watching the sunrise, trying to get the sunset in, taking note of what takes you autonomically, you know, off the board, and trying to avoid those things or regulate those things. Andrew Huberman, I don't know if you know who he is. I've learned so much from him in neuroscience, and I love his content. But
he speaks
about this NSDR. Oh, amazing. So non-sleep deep rest, and that I think is perfect for people to use those resources at that 3 o'clock point, you know, really just trying to just calm down, slow down, get back to where I started. Okay, I'm good. And then get back into the day because yes, we live rushed lives and we're busy and we're multitasking. There's so much going on. And oftentimes we just love it all, but it's all just too much to do at the same time. So wow. Thank you so much, Sinead. I am blown away by what you have shared with us. And like I said before, there's going to be many dropped jaws of people listening to this because this is jam-packed with incredibly valuable information, information that you spent years curating and really understanding deeply, and not just looking at physio, but looking broad and bringing that all together for us. I am so grateful for the work that you do for physios and patients and every other medical practitioner out there. So Sinead, tell us how can people engage with you more? How can they learn from you more, and where can they reach you?
Absolutely. So people can connect with me if you're on Instagram. I'm only on Instagram in the last year. It's very much a professional account. It's all really about knowledge translation. So certainly if you're on Instagram, you can DM me through Instagram if you want to chat or have a question. And certainly you can kind of follow some of my content. The other place you can connect with me is actually through my courses. So if you are really feeling like you want to learn more, maybe you feel like you need to be a little bit more convinced, you want kind of more specifics about the research, you want kind of a better understanding of, okay, I'm sold, but what does this actually look like with one of my clients? I teach a course through a company called Reframe Rehab, and I know all that information will be in the show notes, but I teach a course on pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, but I also teach a very short course on lifestyle interventions and health coaching. So sometimes people hear me do, you know, a podcast like this, and anyone who's heard me speak before, you'll recognize I'm always weaving in about some form of lifestyle interventions, whether I'm talking about diastasis rectus abdominis, whether I'm talking about pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, whether I'm talking about anything pregnancy or postpartum related, because the data there is so strong. But PTs and other healthcare practitioners sometimes just don't know, how do we enact that without stepping out of our scope? Like, what are the best ways to do that, right? And that's really where the health coaching side comes in. So I teach a very brief, just 3-hour course on that, also through Reframe Rehab. So yeah, through Instagram, through Reframe Rehab, or even actually through The Womb, The World of My Baby. I'm the director of pelvic health here. This is where I run my clinical practice. And you can connect with me through The Womb as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I am 100% certain that there's going to be a lot of people. Oh, a shame. Sinead's got bad internet. I'm not sure she's gone off the call. But I'm sure there's going to be many people that are going to be very excited to explore more. I know that Sinead's course is one that I am desperate to do. So I will hopefully be getting the time to do that soon. But yes, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you once again to Sinead. I'm not sure if she's on anymore, but luckily her call cut out right at the end of our chat. So thank you for being here. Stay curious, people. This was beautiful. I am over the moon.
Well, NurturePod listeners, until next time, please review and subscribe. And as always, stay curious. As a special treat for listening to today's episode, you can head over to the nurturepelvichealth.com website and use the code NURTUREPOD for 20% discount on all pelvic and sexual health courses.
And now, let's indulge in a gift from Guided by Glow, whose mission it is to create a transformational practice of awakening your sensual feeling body, igniting your imagination, and cultivating a positive and thriving sexual relationship with yourself. Try today and take $20 off your annual membership using promo code NURTURE. Go to guidedbyglow.com or find it in the App Store.